Welcome to a financial planning podcast with a down-to-earth vibe. Sasquatch listens while editing his TikTok videos. This is Through the Pines. On this episode, we will explore portfolio types. So we're talking about like stocks, bonds, mutual funds, and then we'll also get into, you know, what's an aggressive versus defensive or income versus speculative portfolio type. Joining us for this episode, our advisors are Rex Baxter and Brandon Smith with planwithbaxter.com. Rex, how are you?
Hey, doing great. Thanks for having us.
I thought you were going to use a tagline that we can't use in the industry because there's a famous radio personality who uses it. And I for some reason, I heard it coming out of your mouth, but it didn't come out. So that made me happy. Also in studio, Brandon Smith, again, planwithbaxter.com. Two years in a row, Forbes Best In-State Wealth Management Teams for Utah. Also Advisor Hub, fastest growing advisors to watch, under $1 billion. Are you going to break that? Are you going over? Is there like an under $2 billion thing too, or under $3
billion? At the moment, they may have a $10 billion and above club. I can't remember. But
$10 billion. Wow.
No, we're still a ways. We might cross that during my career. We'll see. So
that'd be awesome.
That's a lot of money. So
also the receivers of the Ameriprise Client Experience Award. So they do know exactly what they are talking about. Please visit them at planwithbaxter.com. For more information, let's dive in first with portfolio types. It's more like definitions, Rex. And so if someone says, well, I have a stock portfolio, what does that mean?
That means, in my mind, that they own either a bunch of individual stocks. So you might own ABC stock, XYZ stock, Elemental P stock, whatever, right? Or they own a bunch of stock-based mutual funds. The underlying core investment is equities, is stocks, is individual stock ownership. When I hear that, that's what that means to me. So,
okay. Brandon?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of different...
Because isn't there just a definition of this? Or why is this kind of a difficult question to answer?
There's a lot of definitions. The problem is people have their own kind of their own verbiage, right? Like someone else come say, yeah, I'm an aggressive investor. What does that mean? Right.
I mean, we're going to get there, but just a stock portfolio. What is that?
So by definition, a stock portfolio is a portfolio that has a bunch of different stocks, right? So you've built up in one account, you've got a bunch of different stock positions. Now you can do that with individual stocks like Rex was talking about, or you can do it with mutual funds, ETFs. I mean, there's a lot of different ways to build a stock portfolio.
Okay.
Someone might even call, you know, stock portfolio a balanced portfolio that has more than just stocks in it, stocks and bonds and alternatives and things like that.
You are so jumping ahead, right? Yes, of course. So
you thunder stealer.
But stocks are, you have ownership, you have equity in companies, correct?
Correct.
Okay. And that's your that's basically the majority of your portfolio.
Right.
Okay. All right. But
that's the whole problem though, Brandon, right? Is everybody out there has their own definitions. And so, you know, just because that's an industry definition and a professional definition, the problem is a regular client will come to us and say, hey, I've got this stock portfolio. And I'm like, okay, well, let me see what's actually in it. Because somebody says that to me. I have no idea what's in it until I look at it.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. So bonds. What's a bond portfolio, Rex?
So a bond portfolio would be a portfolio, a basket of bonds, somebody that owns a lot of individual bonds. Mm-hmm. And so it could be corporate bonds, it could be government agency bonds, treasury bonds, it could be municipal bonds. You know, a lot of different kinds of bonds but that would be a bond portfolio of two or more bonds. It could be, you know, varied on maturity, varied on credit ratings, varied on all kinds of other issues. But at its core, you're going to own a bond. And that's going to beg the question, what's a bond, right? And we've covered this, I think, I don't know, umpteen years ago in like one of our first two podcasts, I think, in definitions. But a bond is essentially you're loaning a bank or a company or a government agency, you're loaning them money for a certain amount of time. And in return, they're going to pay you an interest rate over that time period. And at the end of the time period, they're supposed to give you your money back. And so that's why credit ratings is important and all these other issues. But in essence, you're the lender of the money to that institution. And in return, you're getting paid, income stream for it.
Yeah. Well, that sounds good. Brandon, do you see strictly bond portfolios where some that's all somebody owns? Do you see this often?
Not usually. Sometimes. Typically people that have just straight bonds, there's probably some education, right, that can benefit them. The main reason being, depending on the
portfolio. Is that code for like they're doing it wrong, or
not necessarily, but probably. If you have a portfolio just of straight bonds, the question needs to be asked, well, what's your time frame, right? And if your time frame is really, really short, like 5 years or something like that, where I'm going to need all this money and I want to be really, really safe with it, and I understand the risks that come with bonds, because a bond portfolio has a different risk profile than a stock portfolio, right? The things that are going to make a bond portfolio go up and down are different than what are going to make a stock portfolio go up or down. And that's why they blend together so beautifully, mm-hmm. and why people use them together. But if you're in a all bond portfolio, you probably need to have a really short time horizon. Most people have a little bit longer time horizon, 10, 20, 30 years. And so if you're in all bonds, the question then is, well, why wouldn't we take some of that and go for something that has a historically better rate of return, mm-hmm. right? Like a stock portfolio. Right. And so usually you kind of blend those two together, and you don't usually see one giant bond portfolio. And unless there's something else going on, right? A company with a directive or there are times when you'll see a bond portfolio, but not very often.
Okay. Well, you're talking about blending everything together. So that the next definition is a mutual fund.
Yeah. So mutual funds are used really to gain a lot of diverse exposure usually when you don't have enough to build like a diverse stock portfolio. If you're going to, if you want, access to like the S&P 500, which usually you'd use an index fund or an ETF, would be very similar to a mutual fund. If you want that broad access, a mutual fund's going to do that for you. So you don't have to go out and buy each individual stock. Usually with mutual funds, we see a lot more strategy being implemented versus ETFs. ETFs and mutual funds are very, very similar in a lot of ways. But in a mutual fund, usually you have a fund manager that is going in and saying, all right, I'm going to buy this or I'm going to sell this. And usually they have an underlying strategy, mm-hmm. right? We're going to look for stocks that have grown their dividend, or we're going to look for stocks that have a lot of cash flow, or whatever their strategy that their mouse trap that they think they're going to, outperform the market with. A mutual fund is typically where you see that. An ETF, on the other hand, is very similar, also has a large, breadth of stocks, except for an ETF typically, not always, but typically doesn't have as much strategy behind it. They're like, we're going to buy the 500 S&P 500 stocks, and we're going to let you basically own those for a very discounted price. And so that, and there's a few other nuances, right? Like an ETF trades live, whereas the mutual funds at the end of the day. But that's, I'd say, a fairly decent breakdown between mutual funds and ETFs.
Rex, most people know what mutual funds are these days, correct?
I mean, they know the term. They know enough to come and say, hey, Rex, I own a mutual fund. And I'm like, that's great. I own a car, right? I mean, it's got pedals and I use my feet for brakes and sometimes I have to push it up hills and, things like that.
Just because it's a Jeep.
That's the only reason.
I think people hear the jargon, hear the name mutual fund. But yet when I ask them, well, what's it in? They're like, I don't know. Is it in tech stocks? Sure. Well, is it in bonds? Do you have a mutual fund full of bonds? Sure.
I think, do you ever get the answer when you ask what's it in? They say my 401k.
Yeah, I get that answer too. Lots of times it's not even it's in my 401k. It's in my works plan, right? Sometimes they don't even know that it's a 401k versus a 403b versus a 457 versus, you know, any of the other employer sponsored retirement plans. And so I think, it's hard because then they get nervous because they realize that they don't know. Now all of a sudden, you know, before they didn't know what they didn't know. Now they know that they don't know what's in it. And so then they start to feel, you know, a little bit foolish and on asking the questions because they feel like, man, I should really know how my money's invested and working for me and what I'm doing. And I don't. And now I'm scared to ask. And you shouldn't be, you know, you should be learning and open to asking and things like that. But a mutual fund in its essence is a basket. That's all it is. It's a basket of investment products. It could be a basket of stocks. It could be a basket of bonds. It could be a basket of the combined stocks and bonds. It could be a basket of real estate investment trusts. It could be a basket of commodity, you know, traded holdings. It could be a basket of any number of things. And so it's just a basket that people can trade in a diversified manner is basically what a mutual fund is.
Okay. All right. An alternative investment or alternative investments. Rex, is this like baseball cards? What are we talking about here?
We're talking about, I think the last example, last time we talked about alternative investments, you brought up like alternative music, like Depeche Mode and different things like that, if I remember right. And so,
I have a big CD collection that I'm sure is worth a lot to somebody somewhere out there of like 90s Depeche Mode CDs. So, yeah.
For the kids listening, that's a compact disc that goes in these contraptions. I'm just kidding. So, alternative investments is an enormously broad category of investment types. And it's essentially a broad enough category that if it doesn't fit into stocks and bonds, then typically it'll fit into private, you know, alternative investments. And so this could be, you've got subcategories like hedge funds, venture capital funds, private equity funds, leveraged debt funds, things like that. And inside of each of those, inside of a hedge fund, it could be any number of additional strategies. You could have, you know, what's called, you know, macro strategies that are looking at macro trends across the world. You could be looking at essentially instruments or different companies are trying to go from private to public. You could be looking at, it's just such a broad category that, if you're going to play in that arena, you need to make sure that you're really knowledgeable on the risks associated. And that's why a lot of our regulators have put in place that you have to be qualified investors or accredited investors, which just means that you have to have a substantial amount of income or substantial amount of assets and significant investment experience in order to buy these different kinds of investments because they're complex. The fee structures are typically complex. The liquidity, as far as your accessibility to access your funds over time, can be very complex. And the volatility, it can be extreme during different periods of time. And so this is a big, big, broad category that people like to use and like to talk about and say, oh, we've got a 5% weighting to alternative investments. That's great. But what is that 5%? What really is it? Or what's that 20% or whatever the percentage is? What really is inside of that? And that's where the rubber meets the road and what you need to be prepared to learn and understand and make sure that you understand how your money's working for you.
Okay. Brandon?
Most times the goal with alternative investments is to have an investment that's going to generate equity-like returns, but not in lockstep with the market, right? That's kind of the ultimate goal. And so the problem I remember when I was in college, I had a finance professor talking about like the pros of some of these alternative strategies. And, you know, if you can get your line to dig when the other one zags, well, that's highly beneficial. The problem is, though, if you completely inverse the market and you do just the opposite of the market, that sounds great until you realize the market's usually, you know, averaging a pretty good upward trend, you know? And so if all of a sudden your alternatives are going down, that's not good, even if it's zigging while the other one's zagging. Another issue that we see a lot with alternatives is because they're so complex, a lot of times the cost on those is higher, and that kind of drags down your overall rate of return. And so definitely not saying alternatives are bad, but it is important to understand them and understand what your expectation is for that when you go into it, just to make sure you know what you're buying.
Next portfolio type would be cash. Brandon, how many types of cash portfolios are there?
Lots. Yeah. Especially now, you know, with interest rates being higher, mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot more exciting things out there. It used to be that everything just paid zero. You know? That kept it simple. But now where we've got CDs and there's varying types of certificates, as well as money market funds, FDIC insured money market funds, non-FDIC insured money market funds. So there's a lot of different things within that cash management. And so, you know, you're looking at yield, you're looking at safety and things like that. But compared to all the other asset classes, kind of more of a boring one.
Okay. Rex, what are your thoughts on cash, and when should someone use a cash or have a cash portfolio?
Cash is king. Isn't that the same?
Cash is king.
Cash is king. Yeah. I think as far as cash is concerned, cash in our world is considered under 12 months in the investment world. So typically, if you have a CD that's maturing in 6 months or 9 months, typically we're going to consider that as kind of a cash investment or a cash alternative if it's that short. If we're talking about a treasury bond that matures in 3 months, treasury note, a treasury bill, something like that, then it's going to be considered cash or a cash investment. And the role that cash plays is one, safety, like Brandon had mentioned, and the other is liquidity, is access to your money during times when you need access to it. And so cash plays a very important role in your overall portfolio. But I frequently find it interesting how often people are overweighted to that, you know, to cash as an asset class in just because of the safety feature. And yet they're losing ground to inflation and to taxes. I mean, if you think about in today's interest rate environment, if you're getting, let's say, for the sake of argument, 3% on your money and inflation's at 4%, already you're going backwards by 1%. But that 3% is going to be taxed. And if you're in the, you know, 22% federal bracket and maybe 5 states, you're losing a third of it, roughly. Then all of a sudden your 3% is really 2%, and inflation is growing up 4%. And so now you're half, your money's worth half as much, basically, as far as growing at half the rate, I guess is the better way to say that, growing at half the rate of the overall economy and the goods and services that you use. And so I think it's important to understand that cash does have a role in a portfolio. Absolutely, but it also is going to be a drag on the overall performance of your portfolio to some extent. So,
okay, that was complicated.
But for cash,
for cash, I was like, it's just cash, and cash is cash. There's a lot more to it. Up next is real estate, and there's a lot of ways to invest in real estate. You want to start this one off, Rex?
Sure. So there are lots of ways, right? You can go out and physically buy a property, go out and buy a house, buy dirt, buy, you know, whatever, get a condo, a townhome, whatever. In an investment portfolio, typically real estate is, we're doing real estate investment trusts or home builders or baskets of things like that, to where we're buying individual companies that are involved in real estate, lumber companies, you know, things like along those lines. But there's a lot of real estate investment trusts. Some are liquid, some are illiquid. They have illiquid real estate investment trusts that sometimes may lock your money up for, you know, 1, 3, 5, 10 years or more. And so when we're investing in real estate in a portfolio, you, again, it can be complex. You want to make sure that you understand what role that's playing in your portfolio. If it's an investment, you know, an investment piece of it, as opposed to physical property. And so in this podcast, let's keep it to kind of the investment realm of real estate.
Okay. Sounds good. Brandon, do you have anything on real estate?
Not so much. Overall, though, I think it's fun. I was listening, this was forever ago, but I was listening to some guy from like the Middle East, and he was talking about, and he had money, you know, and not sure where, but I remember him talking about how, oh, we own like these couple hotels. We own this like auto manufacturer. We own that. Like he like had this whole dynasty built out of, we've got companies in every sector. And so that no matter what happens to the world and the economy, we're going to be set. And I remember being like, how cool is that? And then as I realized, no, that's what we're building, right? Like that's what we're building out of portfolios. Mm. And this is real ownership, right? Even this one subset of stocks, right? That has quite a bit of complexity. We don't just buy stocks, right? They're like, we're cross-checking the different sector types, the different, you know, capitalization structure, large, mid, small size companies, the geographical regions on these. And so it's kind of fun to think about it that way, right? Is that we're building portfolios that are built to kind of resist all the different fluctuations that definitely will come, so that we can, you know, provide and generate that income. But it was just kind of a fun way to think about it, I guess, a little bit differently.
So instead of using a portfolio, he just literally goes out and buys the
company. Yeah, buys portfolios of companies. But the thing about that is that takes on significantly more risk, right? You think that's good. Oh, I own two hotels. Well, that's great. But like, what happens if one of those hotels that might be a tenth of your overall portfolio goes down? I mean, that could be a significant, you know, a significant deal. Or if two of the 10 companies just stop performing, you know, that takes out, you know, 20% of your return.
And so that sounds like this next one, which I didn't even know what to call it. I put it on here like business ownership.
Yeah.
So what is that's more kind of like what he had, right? Because it's not so much real estate, but he was owned the business. Is there a word for that? Like, what are we?
Yeah, I think the word we're looking for is Rex's three pillars, right? I mean, we've got, and in those pillars, right, it's financial markets, it's real estate, and it's business ownership. Mm-hmm. I was actually just the other day up at a camp out, and we were talking, someone was talking about someone that had a significant net worth. And one of the kids there was like, well, how on earth, like, how do you build multi-million dollar net worths? Mm-hmm. And the answer typically is business ownership, right? It has to be a scaled model where you can build in all this, you know, get people working for you and scale an idea. And that turns into something far more valuable than you could have built with your own two hands.
Okay. Rex, did you have any input on like a portfolio of just business ownership?
No, I think, again, it does come back to the three pillars, right? As far as real estate, businesses, and financial assets. But I think it depends on when you talk about a portfolio of businesses, typically I'm thinking of, you know, an entrepreneur type of mind that may own a car wash. They may own a restaurant. In addition to that, they may own a storage unit facility. They may, you know, so they've got this portfolio of different businesses that they're running, and a bunch of, you know, a number of employees to help them run it, as far as that goes. And so you can diversify across business ownership as well. However, there's again a lot of complexities between taxes, liquidity, the lack of liquidity, leverage or debt that typically goes along with a lot of those issues. You know, and so you've got your marketing, you've got your sales units, you've got, you know, all these other pieces that go into that. And I think that's an important piece of somebody's overall net worth, I think, is business ownership. But as far as an investment portfolio, if we're talking about investment portfolios, when we're talking about business ownership, we're talking about owning a stock, right? We're talking about owning a piece of and this isn't a recommendation for any particular holding, but you own a piece of Microsoft or Home Depot or GE or Walmart or any of these other companies that are out there, you know, when you own stock in those companies, you own part of that company. And that is a form of business ownership. And right. So I think that's, you know, when we're talking investment portfolios, that's what we're talking about.
Brandon?
I'd say too, just like stocks and bonds blend so beautifully together in an investment portfolio to make a good investment portfolio, so too do all these asset classes and sectors work together. When we come across a business owner that owns a huge business, but they've just dumped everything into the business and they're towards the end of their career and they don't have any money saved aside, right? They don't have any investment side. That's stressful to them. It almost always is, right? I'm not saying it's a terrible idea. Sometimes that really pays off, but it's stressful not to have that. And so these all really should come together, right? You should have some real estate. If nothing else, your own home, right, is usually a really good idea. But maybe even another, you know, real estate thing on the side. If you can get into individual business ownership, that can be highly beneficial. But if you can also have a stock portfolio and maybe even a cash strategy, you know, alongside that stock portfolio to help with, you know, month to month cash flow, you know, just being efficient with that. And so I think, you know, as humans, we always want to like demonize and glorify one thing over which one's good, which one's bad. And I think the answer with this is they all have their place. Mm-hmm. And when you get into the really affluent, you usually see all of these being used very well.
Mm. Okay. So it is that time in the podcast where we should chat about some more numbers, Brandon.
Yeah, we should. Yeah. All right. So this is kind of a funny one. So you hear about these all the time, but First Trust went to uhaul.com and they, what's fun is you can compare costs, right? And you think that renting a U-Haul is going to cost the same wherever you drive it, right? You drive it, drop it off.
No, I've heard about this.
Yeah, it's not. It's in fact, what they try and do, they're essentially trying to offset their costs. And you know, if they get a bunch of U-Hauls all driving to one section of the country, mm-hmm. they'll make a discount rather than them needing to pay someone to drive it clear back.
Right.
They'll discount it. And
otherwise, they all get stuck in Vegas.
Exactly. Yep. No, that's exactly it. And so there's some comparisons. There's actually four different city groups. And so the first one is LA to Phoenix versus Phoenix to Los Angeles. And the cost, right? If you're in Los Angeles and you want to drive this thing to Phoenix, Arizona, it's going to cost you $1,158 to rent this U-Haul. I think it's 26 foot. If you want to go from Phoenix, Arizona back down to LA, $374.
Ooh,
that's a 3.1 ratio, right? Basically 3 to 1.
Yeah.
They had a few others. San Francisco to Boise is
Boise's hot right now, huh?
Yeah. Huh. And it's so interesting, right? Like, but yeah, so San Francisco, if you're renting it going to Boise, you're at $4,325.
You did not just say four grand.
$4,325. Mm-hmm. If you're in Boise going to San Francisco, it's $674. I mean, just
unreal.
Crazy. That was the biggest ratio.
That's worth flying to Boise, renting the U-Haul, driving to San Francisco, getting what you need to get, and then driving it back, you know?
Yeah.
That might be a lot of gas, a lot of time.
No, but it's just for four, like that price difference is $3,000.
Right.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
One other one I thought was interesting. New York to Naples, Florida. So these are cities, right? New York, to Naples, Florida. If you're going from New York to Florida, it's $5,712. If you're going from Florida to New York, it's $1,429. So a ratio of 4. And so the biggest ratio on that was the San Francisco to Boise.
I didn't know Boise was killing it. That's
their real estate market. Yeah. We go up there sometimes. Man, it's crazy what people are saying about the Boise real estate.
I just remember Rex, when Weber played Boise, that's a big rivalry. So
the other thing I think
was
It was.
One thing to note too, it's not like California's real estate is crashing. It's just a huge state. And you've got lots and lots and lots of people there.
And it's expensive to live there. And so mm-hmm. they're used to paying these amounts. And so if right. they do want to move to Boise, a mountain town or something, it's like, oh yeah, $4,000. It's like, what? That's a Tuesday for me or whatever.
Right.
And the people who live in Boise are like, no, that's a lot of money to move out there. Yep. So it's just a
yeah.
different
lifestyle. You have to wonder how much of it is. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Which is wild. Kind All right. Let's get into some details on like personalities behind these investments. So Rex, if someone comes to you and says, which I'm sure you've heard, and they're like, oh, I'm aggressive. I have an aggressive portfolio. What is that? And what does that mean? It should be a risky portfolio, I assume, more than others, looking for better returns or a higher rate of return. But when you hear aggressive or someone comes to you with that verbiage, what goes through your mind?
So that's a good, that, yeah. What goes through my mind?
Okay, yeah. Man, let's hear what
else. Do we have enough room for an entire additional podcast? No, I'm just kidding.
That I'm just much, huh? Wow.
So it's just so funny because, yeah, don't ever ask me what's on my mind. an aggressive portfolio means so many different things to so many different people. That again, it's just all of these things. When somebody says them to me, it's just vague, right? And because it could mean something so different for everybody. I've had people come to me and say, "Yeah, I've got this aggressive portfolio. I want you to take a look at it." And they own two tech stocks, and it's like, one, is that really in a portfolio? And I mean, that's, you know, that's more speculative than it is aggressive. It's, you know, hyper aggressive, whatever you want to call it, right? And then I've had other portfolio.
Like how many right. stocks in portfolio? 3, 7? Right. I mean,
yeah. 2? I mean, what, yeah. what's the number, right? And right. and so, you know, most, yeah. So I think I've had people come to me and say, I have an aggressive portfolio, and they've had about half of their money in stocks. But because the portfolio went down 10%, in their mind, that's aggressive in their mind. Mm-hmm. All of these are extremely vague, which as a financial advisor, we just want to do some probing a little bit and kind of push back a little bit as to what does aggressive mean to you? Why is it aggressive? How do you feel when the market goes up this X amount and your portfolio goes up Y, or the market goes down by, you know, a certain amount and your portfolio goes down, you know, a different amount? How are you feeling about these different time periods? And that helps me get a better sense for, one, their risk tolerance, how aggressive they can be or want to be. But typically, if you're talking an aggressive portfolio, to me, an aggressive portfolio means that you're virtually all equities, right? You're all risk assets, or 90% or more risk assets would be an aggressive portfolio. And when I say risk assets, it could be individual stocks, it could be stock mutual funds. It could be a combination of stocks and stock mutual funds and alternative investments, some real estate holdings, things like that. All of those would be components of an aggressive portfolio to me.
Brandon, what's your experience when someone comes to you with the definition of I've got an aggressive portfolio?
Yeah, same thing. Just got to look at it. Right. Because people's definitions are all over. And not only that, but their mental accounting is all over the place. I'll get someone that will come up and be like, hey, I don't want to take a lot of risk. And then I'll look at their portfolio and it is taking incredible amount, like tons of risk. Right. And they're so adamant that they're cautious, that they're conservative. And then they've got literally 3/4 of their money in one stock. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, this is about as risky as it comes, right? If something happens, well, I think this company is a good company, and that may be true, right? But that's a lot of risk, right? Yeah. One company is going to move around a lot more than an entire economy, and it has the potential to move around a lot faster than an entire economy. And so, you know, helping people understand what risk is and really understanding the potential of what might happen, you know?
Yeah.
I think it's so easy to, in our heads, get like this vision of what we think is going to happen over the next 5 years and just cling to that and not understand that truly nobody knows, right? Well, if we're really being honest with ourselves and we're sitting here today, any one of a million plus different scenarios could happen with all varying effects on the different portfolios. And so you need, when we build a portfolio, we need to build it such that we can maintain, you know, we can take the distributions you're going to need to take while also positioning to take advantage of growth in the most, you know, in the most likely scenarios.
Mm-hmm. Well, the opposite of that is a defensive position. And I found some of these on an article on Investopedia where this definition that they showed for a defensive portfolio is a portfolio that focuses on consumer staples that are impervious or resistant to downturns. Is that possible to do, Brandon?
Kind of, you know, I mean, the definitions, right?
Rex is shaking his head. No.
There are different positions that are more prone, right? So a cruise line stock is going to be very, very not defensive, right? If we go into an economic downward turn, right? What happens to cruise lines? Well, I mean, their revenue goes down. Because that's one of the first things people cut. Well, maybe this year we won't take that nice vacation. We'll kind of budget down. What does really well in those scenarios? Comfort foods, right? Coke, Coca-Cola and Pepsi, right? Those
those all go up and down.
Everything goes up and down, but some things are a lot more resilient than others, right? Obviously, one of the classic ones is utilities, right? Like an electrical company. It's not like people are like, well, we'll cut the electricity for this year. You know, like you're still going to maybe turn off the lights more, but you're still going to see those revenue. And so they're, you know, depending on the sector that you're in, and we watch that on portfolios, how much is in defensive versus more of the opportunistic, right? In the different sections. But yeah, you should be aware of what is defensive. On the flip side, if you're in a bunch of defensive stuff, that's typically lower risk, and therefore your returns are a little bit more muted as well.
Okay, Rex, is it possible to have a portfolio that is impervious to downturns?
I don't think so. I mean, a downturn can hit any sector of the economy at any point in time. Right. People saw that and lived through that in 2008. There just wasn't a place to hide during the Great Recession. You know, utility companies were down, energy companies were down, financial companies were down, tech companies were down, you know, healthcare companies. You look at all the sectors of the economy and they were all down. You look at bonds were down. And so I think that's a fallacy to think that you're going to build a portfolio that's impervious to downturns. It is. It just depends on what is the market environment that will cause those downturns. And are you willing to accept those types of downturns and lose the upside potential of a more balanced portfolio? Or are you not happy with that? Meaning that if you have a defensive stock portfolio that's invested in staple, you know, consumer staples and utilities and things along those lines, and all of a sudden tech and the S&P and everything else skyrockets, it's amazing how quickly people's risk tolerance changes. And this is the problem, is that all of a sudden they get the I want some of that syndrome. And that is that they buy stocks high after it's done really, really well, because now they perceive it to be less risky because it's doing so well. When in reality, that's typically the most aggressive time, the most risky time to buy those companies. And then it goes down a ton, and then they get frustrated and they're like, man, I should have stuck with my defensive stocks. Look how well they're doing. And then they switch out of the aggressive portfolio at the bottom. They go buy the defensive portfolio at the bottom. And it's a cycle that just continues on and on. And super frustrating to watch people go through. And yet very much human nature to make the wrong decisions at the wrong time.
All right, I got to move through these last three fairly quickly. Rex, what would be considered the definition of an income portfolio?
So typically an income portfolio is a portfolio that's kicking off, well, income. And so it's kicking off dividends as income. Do you like how I defined it with its own name?
Yep.
So an income portfolio is there to generate cash flow to you, whether it be through dividends or whether it be through interest payments on fixed income. But typically that's what you're trying to build. If you're building an income-based portfolio, as to where the profits are getting kicked out to you through distributions, through dividend payments, or again, interest payments, one or the other.
I think the best part of those that I've seen when they've been used is the psychological aspect of that. People say, hey, this is our income, this is our dividend rate, or here's our coupon rate off of the bonds, right? And they can kind of ignore the fluctuating, you know, portfolio price, the ups and downs, because like, I'm getting my income, right? And even if the price goes down, I still take my income. And so you see people able to get in a little bit better headspace that way, even though personally, I think, you know, being a little bit more well-rounded in your portfolio construction, yeah, have some income, but let's make sure that we're, you know, taking advantage of all the asset sectors. I mean, I think that makes the most sense, but sometimes people just zero in on their dividend paying stocks and just marry that and feel so good about
it's very trendy right now. So on YouTube and X, Twitter, these influencers are like dividend pros, like dividend pushers, you know, that's they're trying to teach you how to buy the right stocks for dividends income.
Yeah. It's easy to understand and the story's compelling. Mm-hmm. And you know what, like if that's what it takes, you know, to get fully behind a portfolio, then that's not the worst thing in the world, but I think you are leaving some opportunity on the table.
All right. The next one is speculative, and Rex, they define this one with the word in it, speculative portfolio this is the one where they just didn't even define it. They just said this is for the faint of heart.
Not for the faint of heart.
So I don't even know what that means. Like, I don't even know, like, what's so speculative? What are they trying to get
to me when you're putting together a speculative portfolio or things like that? I'm a big believer that over time stocks will follow earnings. Is the more profit, the more earnings a company has, the more valuable that company is. And so when I'm thinking about speculative holdings, that's typically companies that aren't making money, right? It's companies that are losing money. They're having to raise money. They're having to, you know, and you're banking on the fact that it somewhere 5 years out, 10 years out, 3 years out, whatever the time frame is, that they're able to turn this from a money losing business to a money making business. And that is speculative. Right, you're betting on the fact that it's going to be a money making business, and you don't know yet. Nobody can predict that future, and so that is a speculative portfolio. Is companies like that? Sometimes you'll get into penny stocks, low price stocks, things like that. Some people will play derivatives off of companies, whether it be option contracts or different things like that. Those are all components. Or can be components to a speculative portfolio.
There's a new show on, I believe it's the Discovery Channel, and it covers these guys who basically try to beat casinos and stuff like that. But the one guy, he went all in on like beating game shows. And it was awesome, right? He really worked at trying to beat these game shows. And so this is his speculative investment, was to beat all these game shows. And there's a punchline here, but he finally wins. It was like 60 grand or something on this show, but it was one of those shows where, it had to go to episode two. So he was doing so well that episode one aired, but episode two didn't. Well, in the fine print, it said, you don't get your money unless your episode airs. And it never aired because the show got canceled. And he had won like 60 grand, but never got the money because in the fine print, it has to air. And so it's pretty funny. He ended up finally getting the money, and I can't remember exactly how or what happened, but he was like, went after like, come on, like, this is my, like, I, like, right. Are you kidding me?
I devoted my life to this.
Read the fine print. I'm telling you what, pretty wild. And that's speculative. I mean, if that's the way you're trying to make your money, good night. Okay. Finally, last one is hybrid. And we kind of talked about this, Brandon, because you brought up, like, you know, Rex likes to have multiple, folders of income and investments, and
not just Rex, but most people.
Yeah. So then they call it the hybrid portfolio, but it's just a diversification across the asset classes is really all it is. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And watching for opportunities, right. And some sectors are more opportunistic than others at different very points in time. Right. Mm-hmm. And it's important not to try and read too far, right? When you start predicting the future and you're like, oh, growth is going to just dominate, so I'm going to shift every... Now you're going almost into a speculative portfolio, mm-hmm. right? When you're swinging too far. It's good to take advantages of little things. Like, for example, as interest rates were rising, right? Rex and I shortened the duration of our fixed income, which is essentially to say we lessened how long those bonds were out, because as interest rates rise, you don't want your bond portfolio to get killed. And then as we got towards the top of that interest rate cycle where we're kind of in now, we've extended that out to get, you know, lock in those higher rates for longer. And so, I mean, it's okay to watch markets and to try and take advantage, but it's also important to make sure that you stay within reasonable parameters and not just get too locked in on one idea that you have that is going to make or break the portfolio.
Rex, final word on hybrid portfolios?
No, I think another name for a hybrid portfolio would be a globally diversified portfolio, right? It's something, a portfolio that owns a lot of different asset classes, a lot of different sectors of the economy. And I think that typically provides a little smoother ride for people over time and can still get you a strong rate of return over time. But it does come back to the saying that you hear me say a lot, that, you know, concentration is the number one creator of wealth, and concentration is the number one destroyer of wealth. And that's what a hybrid portfolio is there to do, is to protect that wealth. It's there to diversify out the risk, spread it across a lot of different assets and asset classes in order to kind of smooth that ride out a little bit, so that you're not having such wild swings that you're panicking out at the top or the bottom, things like that. And so I think the biggest thing is, as we go through this podcast, is to make sure that you're understanding the jargon, understanding the language, and that you're speaking the same terminology as your advisor. Mm-hmm. So that if your advisor says, hey, I'm going to put you in an aggressive portfolio, what is that? And make sure that you're on the same page. So I think too often there's a disconnect between, you know, what the clients are saying and what the advisors are saying. So. Yeah.
Rex Baxter, Brandon Smith, planwithbaxter.com for more information. Thanks for helping us understand these different portfolio types here today. Please find Through the Pines on Facebook. We're at Pines Podcast, and also on Instagram, Pines_podcast. This has been Through the Pines, reminding you to use yesterday's dollars to finance tomorrow's dreams.